It's time for What's Up with Steve Abel from the Green Party.
Yes, it is, and we've got Steve on the line. Morena.
Morena, how are you?
Morena, Steve.
Yeah, good, thank you. Good. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. We're in an urgency week this week, so we've got a few midnight finishes coming up.
And just had scrutiny week as well, so it's a busy old time for you all at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Awesome. I do want to jump right in and start talking about this tax policy announcement from the Green Party, which has been the big news for you guys over the last couple of weeks. It's planning to provide $32 billion over 4 years, largely by taxing the super rich. Who are we talking about here when we refer to the super rich? And, you know, I know it's a little bit of a how long is a piece of string question, but at what point is someone too wealthy in Aotearoa, do you think?
So the super rich we're categorising as people who have a net wealth above $10 million. So what that means in practice is that the first $10 million of anybody's wealth won't be taxed. And then above that, every dollar above that, they will be taxed at 2.5%. In practice, that captures 0.3% of the total New Zealand population. So it's not even the 1% that are going to have to pay the wealth tax. It's, you know, a third of the 1%.
Mm-hmm. It is quite a sort of modest version of the original plan outlined in 2025, producing less than half of the $88 billion outlined in that strategy. What sort of changed for you all to decide to water it down in this way?
Yeah, basically, it was a recognition that for people there was confusion around the $2 million, which was the original one. For every person would only pay tax above $2 million of net worth, i.e. non-debt, and having no debt on that worth, which would still capture a tiny fraction of the population. But there was just a lot of confusion around what it meant, whether it would impact people who had no cash yet, no cash value, but had, you know, net value in the house, say. And we just wanted to make it super clear that this is about equaling the balance on people who are really in a category of wealth that very few of us will ever experience. Well, probably very few of us will ever meet people who have this sort of wealth. They're not just people with tens of millions of dollars and hundreds of millions of dollars, but people with billions of dollars.
For people who possess that wealth and hold it majority, you know, within their sort of assets, will they be able to defer paying that sort of tax until those assets are sold? Or how's that going to work in terms of coming up with that money if all of their wealth is sitting in assets?
No, they'll have to pay it. They won't be able to defer in the same way because basically, imagine sort of dragon sitting on a massive pile of gold. It's not doing anything. Like, most of it is just accumulating itself through the way that our financial system works. It doesn't contribute to productivity. It doesn't assist us in paying the costs of running an equitable society, paying for our hospitals, paying for the infrastructure we need, paying for the fire service, paying for, you know, protecting the environment and, you know, the public transport system. For the good of the whole society, for all of us, we need to, those who are most able to afford, to pay something of what they have. And the practical reality of the way that sort of accumulated wealth works is that people with those millions and billions of dollars pay less tax than most of us in terms of what they actually own, like around 9%, whereas, you know, your average school teacher is paying 22% of their income on tax. Someone who's in tens and billions of dollars is paying 9%. So it's totally not sort of equitable the way it currently works.
Sure.
Obviously, the volume of money that they contribute will be bigger because they've got more money, but in terms of how it will impact their lives, it's nominal.
Sure, but if that, you know, $10 million plus of assets aren't necessarily generating fluid income, where is that 2.5% tax payment going to come from?
Yeah, well, they have to have some way of demonstrating that they've got cash. They have to, you know, find a way to pay the tax.
Right, okay. One of the big sort of criticisms coming out of, you know, the current government as well as some economists is the worry that, you know, increasing a whole bunch of wealth taxes is going to push successful businesses out of the country. What's your response to this?
It doesn't stack up. It's a classic line that we kind of hear from the right wing, but in fact, it's not how it works in practice. We're slightly raising the tax on the very biggest, wealthiest businesses in the country, who pay, you know, who again make billions of dollars, most of which they repatriate overseas, like the banks and the like, who are Australian owned. So we're making our tax rate similar to what it is in Australia. So I don't see that there's any kind of credible case for that being what's going to happen.
Is that a cost that could be passed on to consumers, though?
I mean, you can argue about that any tax, but it can be passed on to consumers, yeah. Mm. And so the reality is that if we just undertax the very wealthiest for fear that they will, if they're running businesses, pass on costs to consumers, means we're in a race to the bottom. And the argument becomes that, you know, we should just be taxing less and less and less because that somehow saves consumers money. In fact, that's not how it works. By having a fair tax system, we're able to pay for the basic services that everyone is entitled to. That makes a more equitable society. People can afford, for example, they can afford to go to university because the last year of university is going to be free under a different regime. They can afford to go to the hospital when they need to. They can afford to have a doctor's visit when they actually need to go to the doctor. Right now, people can't afford to do that. People can't even afford to put food on the table because of the cost of living. Mm-hmm. We can help to address those problems by having a sufficient amount of money in the public coffers.
Okay, and let's look at Labor's response so far to the proposed tax policy from the Greens.
Do we have to?
Well, they're potentially your coalition partner if you get in, so yeah, we probably should. Chris Hipkins has said it's a big no to wealth taxes, inheritance taxes and increased corporate taxes. He worries that it's going to push the wealthy to move their money around in ways to try and sidestep the system. What are the Greens going to do to, if this policy can get over the line, should you come into government, what are you going to do to ensure that people aren't moving their money around and sidestepping the system in all sorts of ways?
Hmm. Is he from a left-wing party? I can't quite remember. And for me, I feel, my mother was a card-carrying Labor member at a point in her life, and she would be turning in her grave to think that Labor now no longer believes in wealth redistribution. Like, this is the party that founded the welfare state in the 1930s and 40s. What has happened? Like, you don't want to tax people who have over $10 million of wealth a little bit more.
But it's a valid concern, isn't it, to worry that the wealthy are going to be, moving their wealth around as they have done for many years.
Yeah.
What are the Greens going to do in terms of actually implementing this policy, that the mechanics of it all, to ensure that this doesn't happen?
Well, we take the negotiating table, as we do with all of our policies. I mean, the fact is, if you're forming a coalition with another party, the reason you have different political parties is you have different views on how politics should be done, whether that's on the left side or the right side of the house or somewhere in between. So, that's the fact of it. We have to go to the table and say, look, this is a high priority for us. What are you guys going to do to meet us in the middle on this somewhere? That's the likes and the negotiations that you go into in MMP political system.
Right. I do want to touch briefly before we let you go on the Conservation Amendment Bill, because this has been a hot topic. I know it's gotten pretty heated through scrutiny week, and the government has since sort of backed down on parts of the Conservation Amendment Bill. Can you run us through where it's sitting at the moment and whether the Greens are happy with the changes that have been made?
Yeah, I mean, the quick answer is no. Like, it's a little back down. It's kind of like around the fisheries bill when they moved away from the landing of the undersized fish bit, but really the whole bill had to be binned, and they have subsequently delayed that till March, which means the fisheries bill is a election campaign issue. The conservation estate is the same thing. They've kind of pulled back from one little bit of it, i.e. having 60% of it available for potential sale, but lots of the other bits of it, mainly orienting the whole purpose of the Conservation Act around, financial exploitation or economic exploitation has been its purpose. That totally changes why we have conservation estate, to protect it for its biodiversity values, for the extraordinary taonga species that are there, for the landscapes, the rivers, the mountains. That's why people are so outraged about the idea that this bill could be passed. So our view is the whole thing has to be binned, and not just delayed till after the election. It needs to be got rid of.
Mm-hmm. Conservation Minister Tama Pōtaka has since come out, you know, since these percentages and images were released by the Green Party and Forest and Bird, the Conservation Minister has sort of said that that was never the intention to put up this huge amount of land for sale. Do you think he's being honest there?
Well, the legislation says that that's what's capable of being done. I mean, the legislation is black and white ink on the table, and we went through and looked at what it actually says. The law that he drafted would have allowed up to 60% of the country, 60% of the conservation estate, to be sold at some point. He might admit, whether it was his intention or not, that's what the legislation was that he wrote. And the other thing to be clear about is that there's a big drive for what they call critical minerals, a lot of which are war minerals, the likes of vanadium and tinamy that they want to sell to the United States, which are used in military hardware. A lot of those minerals are in conservation land. So Greenpeace put out a really good map that shows, an interactive map that shows where all those minerals are. I think there is a big driver for there to be a lot more mining on conservation land. I mean, we know there is, and Shane Jones has been pretty forthright about that. So I don't. I do believe that they genuinely do want to open up a lot more mind to economic exploitation, and that's why they had such a big swathe of that conservation estate up for potential sale.
Mm-hmm. The minister has also argued, though, that there are some important potential conversations that need to be had about parts of land that DOC currently own that maybe they shouldn't, like the Met Service building in Wellington that doesn't necessarily have a lot of conservation value. Should we be having a conversation about these areas of land that could be used to, you know, make money to invest back into conservation?
That argument is total garbage because they can already do that. There's already allowances in the Conservation Act for things like an old building on a bit of ecologically insignificant land to be divested from, to be sold. Like that already happens all the time. So the argument that they needed to allow 60% to be available for possible sale so that they can get rid of the Met Service building is garbage. They can do it now. They don't even need to change the law to do it.
Right. So you think that's a cover up for the
It is. I mean, I'm going to come up with some stuff soon about how many mining concessions have been issued recently in conservation land by this government. So we know that they're pushing hard for more economic exploitation of areas of land, most of which is hilly. It's like includes the entire Southern Alps, for example. It's mountains and, you know, ravines and ice and snow and stuff. As well as extraordinary ancient Gondwanan forests. And what they're pushing for is economic exploitation of those areas, which will destroy the ecology, the likes of the Denniston Plateau mine, as well as other mines. And it changes the purpose of the conservation estate from protecting these extraordinary ecologies and species that we have to how do people from an Aussie mining company make a few bucks in 2 years and leave the right mess for the rest of us to deal with.
Right. We could get into... Oh, I'm just thinking we're probably running out of time. But speaking on mining industry royalties and profit made from there, it's something that hasn't been included in the Greens' tax policy modelling at the moment in terms of the corporate tax, but is something you guys are looking at potentially?
Yeah, we've previously had mining royalty... And we do have a policy of increasing royalties on mining. It's something we can do. But in many ways, it's a bit of a red herring to implying that, you know, more mining's a good thing, we just need to have slightly more royalties on it. So that's not something that we wanted to kind of flag as a priority for us. We're committed to revoking the most destructive of the fast-track mining consents for coal, seabed mining, and gold. We've already made that commitment at the end of last year. But we also will not allow mining on conservation estate. Conservation land is for conservation.
Mm. Steve Abel, thank you very much for your time this morning. Always a pleasure to cordial with you, and wishing you a lovely rest of your Wednesday.
Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Kia ora.
That was What's Up with Steve Abel from the Green Party.